Fathers out there that missed last week, I still have this candy bar sitting up here. I'm wondering who to give it to. All right. I'm going to throw it to you. Nice. One more week up here, it would have been gone. We are going to be back in Mark today. The Gospel of Mark, chapter 3. Gospel of Mark, chapter 3, and we will start in verse 7. And as you're turning, then I'll tell you. We were out to eat last Sunday after church, me and my wife and kids, and we went out to eat with a couple of the ladies from church here, and we started talking a lot about how much farming's changed over the years. It's changed a lot. I mean, my grandpa, it was funny, my grandpa used to sit there and when he'd refill his tractor, you know, he refilled it by hand. He'd sit there and he'd be cranking and cranking and cranking and cranking and cranking. Cranking fuel, right? 100 and some gallons of fuel. And how many gallons it takes to fill up a Steiger tractor? It's a lot. And now we've got these fancy fuel pumps and it fills them up in like nothing flat. You know, but it's still an inconvenience to stop and fill them up. It's amazing how much farming has changed. I mean, it's rare that you would find an 8-inch auger now, it seems like. Everyone's got 13-inch augers or belt augers, and you just throw them in there full throttle. You got giant combines. You don't need as much help because you got bigger equipment, that sort of thing. Farming's really, really changed. Until it comes to, like, harvest time. Some reason at harvest time, I remember growing up on the farm, on our wheat farm, we had enough wheat that my dad would never buy a combine. Because, did you bring one of those this morning? Did you got a combine? I'll bring it up here. We'll use it to illustrate with. He brought tractors. I saw that. Well, my dad would never buy a combine because we just had too much ground. We had too much wheat. Because one combine or two combines just wasn't enough. Because you guys know this time of year, as we saw in Crawford a couple days ago, I mean, these storms come in and they can wipe out everything real quick. Actually, there was one year where the harvesters had just pulled into town. I mean, just pulled into town that night. They just got set up that afternoon and a storm came in. Wiped out everything, and the next morning they packed up and left. So that's why we would never buy just one combine, because there was just too much to do. The harvesters came and left within 24 hours that time. And with each rain, the wheat loses its quality, it loses its protein, and so you want to get it out fast. And there's more pressure at harvest time. I think our family prayed harder and more at harvest time, and we hired more help. And I think that, thinking about that, thinking along those lines, is a really good illustration of what's going on in this passage that we're in the Gospel of Mark. We're entering into the busiest time in Jesus' ministry. Things are really picking up for him. His ministry is expanding rapidly. There's a spiritual harvest that's going on, and there's a lot of pressure that's coming with it. And so we're going to see today how Jesus dealt with all of this pressure, all of this ministry pressure. We're seeing the servant under pressure. That's what it's like to be a servant, right? Isn't it? Even when you're a servant, you experience a lot of pressure, especially in ministry. This is really, well, I mean, I think it could be really well aimed for those who are serving in vocational ministry, this morning's message. What's it like? How's it like to live under the pressures of ministry like Jesus did? How did Jesus handle the pressures of ministry? Let's look at that, Mark 3, 7 through 19. It says, Jesus withdrew to the sea with his disciples, and a great multitude from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, and from Jerusalem, and from Idumea, and beyond the Jordan, and the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon. A great number of people heard of all that he was doing and came to him. And he told his disciples that a boat should stand ready for him because of the crowd, so that they would not crowd him, so that they would not crush him, you could say. For he had healed many, with the result that all those who had afflictions pressed around him in order to touch him. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they'd fall down before him and shout, "You're the Son of God." And he earnestly warned them not to tell who he was. And he went up on the mountain, and he summoned those whom he himself wanted, and they came to him. And he appointed 12 so that they would be with him, and that he could send them out to preach and to have authority to cast out demons. And he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James. To them he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder, and Andrew, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. Judas is always listed last with some sort of comment like that. But again, this is the first thing we notice is how busy Jesus had become. I mean, his popularity is growing. He's got all this mounting pressure from the ministry. We're entering into the busiest moments in his ministry. And even though people are still pretty unsure what to think about him, he's become very popular. And he's reached what we could call celebrity status, don't you think? This guy is a celebrity in Israel. He's drawn people from all the nations around. The demons know exactly who he is. Right, a lot of people are unsure who he is. The demons are very sure who he is. He's the Son of God, and they voice that out, as we've seen. But he could care less about the testimony of these demons, right? We've looked at that. He tells them to be quiet. He tells them to get out of the way. He wants people to make their own conclusions about who Jesus is without any sort of demon testimony influencing it. The Pharisees, then, they're the second group. They're certain he's a false teacher. They're certain he's a fraud, a threat to their religious establishment. Jesus has been colliding with these guys several times. They're upset about what he teaches. I mean, for one, he teaches the word of God. He's not teaching their man-made system. They're pretty upset about that. He'd forgiven sins of the paralytic, the sins of the paralytic. That obviously upset them, because only God can do that, and he is God. Number three, he chose Levi, Matthew, the tax collector, to be his disciple. No one did that. No one chooses tax collectors. They hated tax collectors. They wouldn't have anything to do with them. He didn't observe their man-made religious rules, like ceremonial fasting twice a week. He didn't fast twice a week. That broke their man-made system. He ate and drank with tax collectors in his pursuit of sinners, right? In his pursuit of them. And so he's far too scandalous. He hangs out with, you know, too many sinners. Far too scandalous in his grace. And then he broke the Sabbath in their eyes when he let the disciples pick some grain and eat it on the Sabbath. And that was kind of the last straw. Well, that's no pun intended, huh? That was the last straw. That's not even in my notes. That's funny. I haven't got funny jokes. I didn't even know it. That was the last straw, breaking the Sabbath. That really sent them over the edge. And so they started plotting with this group called the Herodians, trying to kill him. They're plotting to kill him. And there was even word, you know, the Herodians, they're friends of Herod. And so word's going around, you know, there's big crowds, kind of like today, got big crowds, right? There's a rumor that an insurrection's going to happen. Pretty relevant. And though Jesus is not afraid of the confrontation with these guys, it does say he withdraws to the sea. It's not his time. He doesn't need to spend all of his time dealing with these constant critics. So he withdraws to the sea, it says. Another reason why he might withdraw was not just because of the plot, but because of the crowds. I mean, he had to be out in the countryside where everyone could gather. I mean, those guys would have destroyed the city if they were all in it at once. Man, that's relevant too. No. People had come from all over. They had come from north to south to east to west. Look at this map. This is where they're coming from. As far south as you can go in Israel, to like as far north, even beyond it, beyond the Jordan. They're all coming from everywhere. This is like the whole territory that was under Solomon. They're all coming to this area. People had come from all over. And the crowds, for the most part, don't know who he is. They're still deciding, as we'll see next week. But for now, it seems that they just think of him as this celebrity miracle worker. He's the guy who's going to come and he's gonna make my life better. He's gonna heal me. Give me an easy life now. Give me my best life now. And so they aren't the most spiritually minded crowd. They're seeking his hand and not his face. They're not really interested in him. They're just kind of looking at what he has to offer. And because of their lack of spiritual mindedness, it's actually right after verse 19. Well, according to the other Gospels, it seems that right after verse 19, in between 19 and 20, is where he preached the Sermon on the Mount. And that really, that was all about spirituality, wasn't it? Their need for righteousness, their need to be righteous. And that was Jesus' priority, was preaching. When the crowds got big, what did Jesus do? He got away from the crowds, he stepped back from the crowds, put a little distance there, and he preached to the crowds. That's what he did. That was his priority. We saw that in chapter 1, verse 38. His priority is preaching and teaching. It's not healing and casting out demons and things. It's preaching and teaching. And so he actually gets into a boat just so he can do that, right? So they won't crush him. Kind of like you think of a boat out in the water. He got into a boat and they pushed it out a little ways. But I don't think it was just so that they wouldn't crush him. I mean, obviously that was a main reason, but I think there's a strategy behind this, because how many of you know that when someone's out on the water in a boat, you can hear their conversations really well, can't you? Like, water is nature's megaphone. Josh, we were out fishing the other day, right? You could hear these four kayakers out in the middle of the lake very clearly. They should have turned their music down, right? Just kidding. or we were in the boat and we heard someone on shore. It was like, it's strange. It's amazing how clear you can hear someone across a lake. The sound travels on water. Water is nature's megaphone. And then, so he's using the water probably as a megaphone, but then the hillside of the Sea of Galilee, I don't have a picture of that, but the hillside of the Sea of Galilee, it's almost like a perfect amphitheater. So he's preaching using nature's megaphone to nature's amphitheater. It's really neat. There's even a specific area that's shaped. Have you ever stood in one of those amphitheaters that's designed to be used without a megaphone? There was one in Portland when I went on a mission trip there. They had a circle that you would stand on and you would just talk. And you could talk like this, but the way the seating was designed, it was amazing. You could hear yourself very clearly and loudly. So the shape of like some of these amphitheaters that you see in the ancient days, like they were designed so that the sound would resonate. Well, Jesus is using nature's amphitheater, nature's megaphone. It was the perfect place to preach to the crowds. There's actually a boat that was unearthed here. You might be interested in just something, maybe what Jesus would have stood in. This is from Jesus' time. This is one of those boats. Pretty small boat. Can you imagine being in something like that, going across the Sea of Galilee, which was a lot like being on McConaughey, in a boat like that when a storm comes up and those waves are crashing and they're white capping? Man, I would not want to be in a little tiny wooden boat like that going across McConaughey when one of those storms comes up. But that's what it looked like. There might not have been much difference between Peter staying in the boat and getting out of the boat on the water. Those waves were crashing. Anyway, the Pharisees think he's a fraud. They want him dead. The crowds are following him, crushing him. They aren't very interested in spiritual things. The government, they got word of an insurrection. You got all this ministry pressure is just kind of through the roof at this point. And how does Jesus deal with it? How does he respond to it? Number one, he uses his God-given platform to speak the truth. Number one, I mean, he owns it. He owns it. He uses it. That's one way to thin out the crowds, though, isn't it? Speak the truth. Thin out the crowds. Speak the truth. He took advantage of the pressure, though, and remembered what was most important, letting people know the truth. But what sometimes happens, think about this, what sometimes happens is when a preacher or something or some Christian businessman kind of becomes popular and they're given a platform, what happens? when they're given a platform before a bunch of people, what happens? Typically, what we're seeing today is they don't speak the truth. They actually start to loosen up, don't they? That's what you're seeing today in some of these big Christian businesses. They start to loosen up on their biblical stances, don't they? They cave in to LGBT, that sort of thing. Right, for fear of what? Offending followers, maybe. Maybe fear some of these Christian businesses are fearing that they'll lose potential customers. How many Christian organizations or businesses lately who have started out on solid biblical principles, have been blessed by God for it, have all of a sudden begun to cave into the pressure put on them by the crowds? That Jesus, instead of backing off from his stance on people's need for righteousness, he actually leaned into it. He leaned into it. He didn't care if the crowds thinned. He didn't care. He knew God had his sheep, right? God has his sheep. They'll listen to his voice. He used the God-given platform to speak truth instead of letting himself get distracted too. Think of this. He could have just been like, well, look at all these physical needs out here. You know, I don't have time to preach. I've just got to be healing and casting out demons. He could have got all sorts of distracted by all that. But he still makes it a point saying, no, I came to preach. I came to preach. I came to preach and teach. That's what people need. People need it. He remembered the spiritual needs were the most important. Mark doesn't present Jesus' popularity, it's really interesting, in a way that most of the world would. Many in our world tend to idolize popularity and try to promote themselves through various platforms. You see it all the time on Facebook and Twitter. And they got the goal, you know, the more followers you have, the more successful you are. I mean, you see it in this musical today. There's a popular musical today called Jesus Christ Superstar. That's kind of a weird thing. I mean, that tells you the way our world thinks. Our world tells you that the more that follow you, the more successful you are. However, Mark reminds us that popularity can be a real hindrance to success in God's eyes. It's actually been said there's three supreme testings in this life. Three supreme testings. You got suffering and poverty, obscurity and unrecognition, and then the last one's prosperity and applause. And these are all tests. I think we all know suffering's a great test. Obviously, persecution, poverty, pain, physical, emotional pain, relational pain, you lose someone, you lose something. Suffering tries us, doesn't it? Suffering tries us. Suffering refines us. And if we're going through it well, we'll let it push us closer to God and not further away from him, right? But we don't often think about testings like the other two, like obscurity and unrecognition or prosperity and applause. Obscurity tests happen upon a person when they have maybe great talent. Maybe they have gifts that God's given them that they're aware of. Maybe God's given them certain great capacities to preach or teach or serve in an area, or they know they would be perfect for a certain job, but for the time being, God doesn't have them serving in that capacity. They're kind of back in the shadows a little bit. They're not being used by him. So they're kind of going unnoticed. They're going neglected. They're being neglected. God has the person in the shadows waiting for his perfect timing to call them to a specific task that he has. Have you ever had one of those moments when you're just sitting there waiting, you're kind of off scene, you're not in the spotlight or nothing, but you're off scene? That's one of the most important times in your life. That is a big test, and it's one of the most important times in your life. And it'll never be it'll never be a time that anybody else appreciates, but it's one that you'll certainly appreciate. There may be a time where he takes you off scene and you kind of enter into the shadows off scene. That's a supreme test in this life. Not being recognized, not being acknowledged. But you got to be faithful in the time of obscurity if you want God to call you out of the shadows and back into something more significant. Being faithful in obscurity and neglect is required to get out of it. If you're in your heart, you have to be able to serve. Now, here's one of the reasons, kind of why Peter would go through such a test that he did. I mean, in your heart, you have to be able to serve. Here's one of the things that he teaches us in these times. In your heart, you have to be able to serve without any applause before you can serve with the applause, or else you'll let the applause get to you. You get that? You have to be able to serve without applause. You have to be able to serve in capacity. Sometimes you have to shine boots. You remember that story? Sometimes God makes you shine boots in a closet somewhere. Sometimes that's good for us. Because popularity, too, that's a great test. Those who pass through their time of neglect, they become popular, they're well-known, or they're given some sort of spotlight or platform, they can be corrupted by success and adulation they receive. It's an equal test. I mean, as already mentioned, they can be tempted to please the crowds for fear of losing newfound significance, or fear of losing potential customers, fear of losing business. And we shouldn't forget that the spotlight, too, the platform, it comes with a full calendar. A full calendar can become a hindrance to our faithfulness to God. It's interesting. Not only that, it can overwhelm men. It can cause them to break down under the unusual and many responsibilities that comes with the popularity. What's interesting is that Jesus faced all three of these tests, if you think about it, in just three short years. Suffering, obscurity, and the prosperity. He went through all three of these tests, and he passed through them all victoriously, but not without feeling it. He felt it. He was a man. He felt these things. One of the things Jesus had to do to manage the ministry pressure was to draw away from the crowds, though, at times. That's the second point there. So he used his platform to speak the truth. Then he finds moments to withdraw from the crowd. There's something to be said about that for sure. That's something he did for short periods of time. On occasions, he would get away. He'd cross over to the other side of the lake. You remember verse 7 says, he withdrew to the sea with his disciples. According to the Gospels, it kind of goes like, it seems like this. I mean, Mark, when he gets to verse 13, he's rewinding the chronology of what happened. So you kind of go like this. Jesus is around the crowds. He leaves the crowds, goes out to the sea or the mountain, goes out to the sea with his disciples. He prays all night long, whatever. In the morning, he calls his disciples to him. And then by that time, the crowds have caught back up again. So he's intentionally getting away from the crowd for a while so he can meet with his disciples. He can meet with the Father. And that's important, I think. It's important to have times in ministry. I mean, especially, I know it now as a pastor. I mean, it's just about in every pastoral counseling ministry out there, you know. A lot of them are in places that are like called getting away, you know, that you would call getting away, getting out into the wilderness or something like that. Kind of like Pastor Giles, he got that Sunscape Ministries, you know, down in Colorado Springs in a beautiful place. You kind of get away. So anyway, that's important, though, to find time to get away a little bit. It's important for hanging in there for the long haul. Sometimes you have to do it. You have to have moments of solitude with the Lord if you're going to minister to the crowds. And I'm not talking about running away from pressures. I'm not talking about caving into the temptation to quit at all. I'm not talking about that at all. Our humanity has its limitations. It just does. Our humanity has its limitations, and it needs a break at times. We talked about this last week, didn't we, with the whole Sabbath thing? That's the reason God made the Sabbath. He knew we needed a break, and we needed a break each week at least. And then in the law, he had all these festivals and feasts and things to break it up even more. So there was like week-long deals, like longer Sabbaths. God knows we need Sabbaths. And Jesus, at times, he had to get away. He had to withdraw. He had to refresh in that sense. He experienced hunger. He experienced thirst. He experienced being worn out. I think he felt the stress of ministry while he was serving his heart out under this sun. He experienced the stress of ministry. I was super thankful for the opportunity myself to get away recently. Man, I needed that. That was great. You guys wouldn't believe the difference that makes. Just one Sunday was all it was. But you need that now and then. And if you're diligent in your work and you give your best every day, you work hard, you don't need to apologize for it. You don't need to feel guilty for it. Sometimes I bet your family and your friends would appreciate it if you'd take a break. Right? Because we don't get our breaks, it's not very attractive. It's important for hanging in there for the long haul. Number three is that when the pressure was on, Jesus knew he needed to pray and pray harder. Luke 6:12 complements the text we're in with more detail. It says it was at this time he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples. He chose 12 of them, whom he also named as apostles. At this time, he went off to the mountain to pray. He spent the whole night in prayer to God. He prayed, and he prayed about what God would have him do next. When things are busy, that's exactly what you need to do. That's a point that we learned from chapter 1, verse 38. You remember that? When things get busier, what tends to go first? Prayer life. And that's the exact opposite thing that should happen. The busier we get, the more we should pray, the more we need to pray. And I know we need to revisit that point because I'm just like you, even though we just went over it a few weeks ago. It's through prayer. That's how we're refilled. That's how we're re-strengthened. We're refocused to do God's will. That's how we discern the next step in God's will for us. God has limitless spiritual resources for us to hold up underneath the pressures that we're in. He has unlimited spiritual resources for us. And yours might not necessarily be ministry, but you have pressure. And you got to go to God in prayer to get the spiritual resources you need. I could say God never runs out of pancakes based on a story I read it years ago. It's from a book called Ruthless Trust. But basically, God never runs out of pancakes. There was a pastor talking about how every Saturday morning he'll get up, he'll make breakfast for his kids. And, you know, he's never noticed his kids ever, like, taking the pancakes that he makes and stuffing them in their pockets for later, you know, hiding them. No, they wolf them down because they know Dad's not going to run out of pancakes. They're not afraid Dad's ever going to run out of pancakes. God's not going to run out of the spiritual resources we need to get through the pressures that we face. He doesn't run out of pancakes. You guys remember that one. A believer, though, that doesn't pray, and a church that doesn't pray, is going to run out of pancakes. Even if they're a busy believer in a busy church, you can be all sorts of busy, but you won't be effective if you don't pray. We got to be praying. Fourthly, though, when the pressure's on, Jesus delegated. That's the last point, I think. Jesus delegated. To delegate is to entrust some tasks to others. He entrusts tasks to others. That's what the Father had him would do after that full night of prayer. That's what Jesus decided to do, to delegate, right? Not even Jesus. Not even Jesus was going to do it all on his own. He appointed the 12, it says, so that they would be with him and that he could send them out to preach and to have authority to cast out demons. So right now what he's essentially saying to them is, I'm choosing you as my apostles. You're going to be by my side. You're going to be listening to me, learning from me, and eventually you're the ones that I'm going to send out. So right now he's choosing them as his apostles, separating them, these 12, from the rest of the disciples that were following him. And he's saying, look, you guys are the ones are going to be by my side. You're the ones I'm going to train up, and you're the ones I'm going to send out. You're going to take over the work for me, and you're going to help me in my work. And it's important that we get to know these men, I think, because these guys become the spiritual leaders of the foundation of the church, right? We're going to get to meet these guys in heaven. They rule over the 12 tribes in the millennium. Their names are on the foundation stones of the New Jerusalem. I mean, you're going to have to walk over their names, okay? Their names are on the foundation stones. And I'm wondering which names they are, their given names or the nicknames, because they all have different names, right? They have more than one name, most of them. God honors them, though, throughout eternity for their ministry. And I think what is encouraging about that? I mean, what's encouraging about the 12 apostles? They have this fancy name, don't they? The apostles. But have you ever studied these guys? These are ordinary men from ordinary walks of life. They're not these stained glass, unrelatable, untouchable saints. You know, that's the kind of picture I grew up with them. Like, they were the stained glass saints that were, like, so far above humanity that I could never be considered a saint because these guys are the saints. You know, that they made a separation there. What's encouraging about these guys is that they were ordinary men. They had an ordinary life. They come from ordinary walks of life. They're doctors and, I mean, fishermen from Galilee. They're all from Galilee, except maybe Judas Iscariot. But God uses these ordinary people to do big things for him. To do big things for him. What's that say about us? He can use us too, right? That's what that's saying. He can use us to do extraordinary things for him. Putting the list of the apostles together, it can be a little difficult because sometimes they're called by their given names, as I said, and sometimes they're called by their nicknames. The nicknames, I think, are fun. The nicknames are really fun for me because it lets us know that these guys just weren't a bunch of stiff-necked Pharisees. You know, they didn't button the top one. Never mind, just kidding. They weren't self-righteous. You know, they had fun. It's a fun group, I think. They were kind of a, I don't just want to call them a motley crew again. They were a great group of guys. They weren't perfect. They were ordinary, and they had a lot of fun, and they served hard in the ministry. Simon Peter. Let's look at these guys. Simon Peter, his name means rock. I think both names mean rock. He thought himself to be a rock in his pride. And then once he denied Jesus, he realized he wasn't so much of a rock. And then and Jesus renamed him Peter, right? Because he says, Peter, you need to be a rock now. You need to be a rock for me. The rock was also the testimony that Jesus is the Christ. And that's the testimony that he took. Acts chapter 2, he preached and... Anyway, James, then you got James and John. These guys are brothers. They're sons of Zebedee. They're called the sons of thunder. The sons of thunder. Isn't that funny? You guys remember the story about that? They're traveling from Samaria, or traveling through Samaria, going up to Jerusalem, and they weren't really received well in a town there. And so Jesus wasn't received well there. And these guys say, Lord, do you want us to command a fire to come down from heaven and consume them? Let's call down the thunder, call down the fire, kind of like Sodom and Gomorrah. And Jesus says, look, I didn't come to destroy men's lives. You don't know what spirit you're of. I came to save them. So that's how they got that name, Sons of Thunder, from that point on. Andrew, that was Simon Peter's brother, Philip. I wonder if he liked horses. He had the name. His name means lover of horses. Bartholomew was also called Nathaniel. Matthew, he was also called Levi. Matthew means the gift of God. How could a tax collector be the gift of God? It's kind of a fun thing going on there. Thomas, he was also called Didymus, a twin. I wonder if he struggled with being a twin. James the Less, he's number 9, the son of Alphaeus. I wonder if James the Less might have just been shorter than the other James. So they called him James the Less. Actually, I grew up with another Justin, and he was there first, and so they called him Justin 1, and I got Justin 2. I was like, Justin the Less. I didn't really care for that one. Then you got number 10, Judas. Judas not Iscariot. So there's two Judases. There's Judas Iscariot and Judas not Iscariot. This poor guy had several names. It was Jude, Judas, Levius, Thaddeus. You got Simon. Simon's a zealot. And Judas Iscariot. He's always listed last. He's always called the one who betrayed him. And he was later replaced by Matthias in Acts chapter 1. But it's quite the group if you really study them in depth. You've got three sets of brothers. Lord knows how hard it is for brothers to work together, right? Two brothers working together. It's pretty difficult. You got two extremes in the group as well. You got Simon the Zealot and Matthew the tax collector. I mean, those two hated each other normally. Zealots were anti-Roman insurrectionists. They literally were. They were called the dagger carriers, assassins sometimes. They might assassinate a Roman soldier when he wasn't watching, when nobody else was looking, right? They might take out someone like Matthew as well, who worked for Rome. And Jesus has these two guys work together. Only Jesus could bring a zealot and a tax collector together and have them be a functioning unit. Three of them are, if you'll notice from the thing here, they're listed in the same place of order each time. So you got Simon Peter's always mentioned first, and Philip number 5th, and then James the son of Alphaeus, he's always mentioned 9th. And all four of the accounts are... scriptures about these guys and all the lists of the apostles. And so some seem to think that that may indicate that even within the apostolic group, they had small group structure, you know, small group leader structures, and they went out by pairs as well. So that's why you see two of them side by side all the time. So when they're writing these things down, they're thinking about how they were organized, you know, and how they went out, that sort of thing. A question to ask, though, is why 12? Why 12 apostles? And I think there's a specific reason for that. I think there's an unmistakable message being sent to the leaders of the nation of Israel, to the Pharisees, these guys who thought of themselves as the leaders. And the message, the unmistakable message, is that they're being replaced. The Messiah's come. They've rejected the Messiah. Now the Messiah's appointing new leadership because they obviously are not qualified for it. There's 12 apostles, right? How many tribes were there? 12 tribes. These guys are the new leaders over the nation of Israel. Luke 22:28, Jesus said to them, "You've stood by me in my trials just as my Father has granted me a kingdom. I grant that you may eat and drink with me at my table in my kingdom, and you will sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." So millennial thrones in the future. They're going to judge the 12 tribes. When Jesus returns, when that kingdom actually comes, according to Luke 22:18, it was still future. So it seems that this judgment, though, this is a judgment on unqualified religious leaders of Israel. He's given them authority. Jesus says, "I'll give you my authority." And what's he doing? He's taking the authority away from the Pharisees. In Acts chapter 6, 7 through 12, we'll get there eventually. After having been at his side for some time, after learning from him, they are going to be sent out to do everything Jesus has been doing with his authority. They'll go out, they'll preach as well. They'll cast out demons, that sort of thing. This is really significant, though, to our point. Right now, he's choosing them as the ones that he's going to train. Okay, he's going to train them, and then later he's going to send them out. That's what delegating is, isn't it? Entrusting tasks to someone else. He's preparing the 12, and by doing this, he is going to get more done. He's deflating some of the pressure that needs, some of the tasks that need to be done, because not everybody's traveling to this spot. There's other people who need to hear, who aren't going to leave, who do have jobs. You know what I'm saying? He's got to get the message out. So he's going to get more done, relieve some of that pressure, and he's going to prepare for the future. He's preparing for the future. Because these guys are going to be the ones to take the gospel to the world, right? And that's what a wise church does. That's what a wise church does. The effective and lasting ministry is a ministry that delegates. Effective and lasting ministry is a ministry that delegates. It's very rewarding as well. When you see someone step into an area where they've never served or something, and they just take it over and they run with it and they're great at it and they're better than you were at it. Wise churches delegate, guys. If a ministry is going to be effective, it's got to have a leader who delegates, and I'm preaching to myself. We have got to delegate. I have got to delegate. Making disciples is all about delegation. You have to take risks. You have to put people in positions who have never been in that position before so that they can discover their gifts and they can grow. Churches that thrive are churches that are delegating. This is a really big point, because one of the things, guys, I've never been able to understand, you've probably seen a lot of it, is when certain church members start complaining when the pastor or a leader of a ministry steps back and actually lets someone else lead. Like, to kind of take a leading role. I mean, I've been part of small groups in the past where the leader, the small group leader who's been there, the one who founded it and everything, they step back, someone else new steps in that leader's been praying for heavily, right? Well, a new leader kind of steps in, a younger one that's never led before, and all of a sudden the group gets really upset because the leader's not leading now. right? And they're not doing as good of a job. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. Because where do you think that leader learned how to lead? It's called discipleship. You know, you have to delegate. Like, you have to think about the future, and you got to put people who are younger in positions where they can grow, where they can discover their gifts, that sort of thing. Leaders have to learn somewhere, right? They learned by their leaders giving them the opportunity to lead. Everyone has to start somewhere. It takes time, it takes practice to develop gifts. If we're going to make disciples here, if we're going to have a vibrant ministry, we have to give people the opportunities to step up, to step in, to have some ownership over certain things, maybe to find their gifts, right? We want our church to be a place where people have those opportunities. Jesus never did it all on his own. He delegated. Moses, you remember Moses? Moses couldn't do it all. He delegated. That was his father. You remember his father-in-law, Jethro, came to visit him, and Jethro's like, "What in the world are you doing, Moses? Like, you're trying to act as the sole judge over this whole nation of Israel, and the thing that you are doing, Moses, is not good." This is what he said. "The thing that you're doing is not good. You will surely wear out both yourself and the people who are with you, for the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone." Jethro suggested selecting able men who could take over certain numbers of others, right? They could rule, act as like under rulers, right? Like, so you got like men appointed over 100, men appointed over 50, and then men appointed over 10, right? He suggested selecting able men who feared God, who are men of truth, to share the load with Moses. The whole congregation of Israel was actually hurt by Moses' trying to do it all. Isn't that something? One man cannot do it all. Moses listened to his father-in-law, and guess what? He was blessed for doing that. Wise old Jethro. Experience will teach you something. In similar fashion, we know from other scriptures, like 1 Corinthians 14, that the local church, it was never meant to be a one-man show either. Like, I actually can't stand it when I have to do the announcements and the prayer and the sermon. I almost feel like I'm sinning. I'm not even kidding you. Because the church is not meant to be that way, is it? It's not. Read 1 Corinthians 14. You'll see what I'm talking about. For us to grow, to be healthy, to be more vibrant, be more effective, we have to learn to value and appreciate everyone's roles, everyone's gifts, everyone's value to the church family. Every one of us has a strategic role in our church's effectiveness. Without delegation, the life of the church is actually going to be stifled when one man does it all. Train and delegate. Train, delegate. Train, delegate. Remember Titus? Don't do it all, Titus. Appoint elders. Train, delegate. Remember 2 Timothy 2:2 now. "The things which you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust these to faithful men who will also be able to teach others also." Right? Men who have been trained, appoint them, delegate. Train and delegate. One of the best places for the training and delegating to take place, I've been reminded of lately, is in a small group. It really is. Just recently, we started that in-home marriage Bible study. There's like six couples coming to this thing, and I can't tell you how refreshing it is. It is a really refreshing group. Six couples, never really got to know each other. We're all of a sudden getting to know each other. We're having a great time. We're learning where each other lives. I mean, we're getting to know each other's personalities, each other's experiences, and it makes a lot more sense when, you know... You know how much less likely you are to judge someone when you get to know them? These small groups are awesome. Our church needs small groups, and I want to preach on that. We need small groups. And I want to be frank about that, because someone was really frank with me about it this week. You got to get past, the small groups really help us to get past being just acquaintances, you know, on Sunday morning. You kind of loosen up. You get to know one another. It also presents opportunities for people to invite others to church. That person who was frank with me this week was telling me all about that. All the benefits they've experienced from this small group. Like, I can invite friends to this. And then not only that, it gives people an opportunity to serve. It gives an opportunity, like, I was gone, right? Someone else stepped in and led that, and they did a better job than I did, I bet. They did a great job. Small groups are a great place to train and delegate. And so don't be surprised if there's a push for that in the future down the road. I'd like to see more of them just naturally crop up. But be a part of one of those if you're not already. They're great. They're awesome. I think we need them. It's not always easy, like, to be a part of a small group or a Bible study, something like that. It's not easy to make it to those. It always takes time out of your schedule. But, man, it's absolutely worth it, and I haven't regretted it. So anyway, that's my soapbox on small groups for the day. And then lastly, I want to point out, too, maybe you're interested in this Wednesday night thing. We got that. We're going to talk about how to reach our youth again. How to reach some of these college students. I mean, if that's something you're interested in, man, come on down. Like, we'd love to have you. 6:30 Wednesday night, we're going to talk about how we can do that. Maybe bring your ideas. And yeah, we need it, right? We need some more people. We need some more brain power. So maybe that's an area where you could step in and serve if you're interested. Lord, thank you so much for today. Thank you for your word. It's